This episode of Rebel Talk is brought to you by Rebel Tech, human stories for startups.
Rebel Shrebel, you've torn your dress. Rebel Shrebel, your face is a mess.
I absolutely believe that there is a backlash against tech coming, and I'm frankly amazed that it hasn't been worse already.
Being an entrepreneur is a lifestyle choice, and I think the name of this podcast is You Need to Be a Rebel. I am absolutely unemployable.
Rebel Shrebel, you torn your dress. Rebel Shrebel, your face is a mess. Rebel Shrebel, how could they know? Hot track, I love you so.
Hello and welcome to Rebel Talk, a brand new podcast that celebrates rebels from every walk of life. Each episode, we talk to the troublemakers whose predilection for bending the rules is driving progress, change and transformation. I'm your host, Mark Schwakey, and today I'm joined by the founders of two of my favourite tech startups. Benji Lagnardo of Pickfair, the image licensing company causing sleepless nights for the likes of Getty and Shutterstock with its commitment to rewarding photographers and their creativity. And Anthony Eskenazi of Just Park, the amazing parking app that's making parking easy for everyone and, says Anthony, leading a £50 billion industry into the digital age. You started Pickfair when you were how old?
29. 30.
Same question, Anthony. You started when you were...
23.
Okay, 23, wow. What are the barriers to young people starting out now? Knowing what you know about how hard it's been and about all the different challenges that have probably grown and developed you, what are the barriers to people starting out now with an idea?
I think a lot of it is the lack of soft skills that have been taught in schools. I look at my kids who are at the very start of their education, and they're still being taught, you know, about Oxbow Lakes and, you know, what's happened in the 1780s. And I think that is important. But where are the negotiation skills? Where are the debating skills? Where are they learning actually how to conduct themselves in business? They're not being taught yet, although I know a number of schools are starting to add that to their curriculum. And I think people are leaving school, leaving university. There's been so much pressure, especially with the introduction of tuition fees. You're getting this education, but how are you going to use that in your career in life?
Have you ever used any knowledge of an Oxbow Lake in practical?
No, but I've used it in a number of podcasts.
Have you?
It's just, I don't believe that I know coding is now being taught as part of the curriculum, which I think is a fantastic step forward.
It's a game changer, yeah.
Absolutely. But being an entrepreneur is a lifestyle choice. And I received no training.
Is it restricted to a certain type of personality, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the name of this podcast is You Need to Be a Rebel. I am absolutely unemployable. I can't imagine doing anything else because I quit my job at Deloitte after 6 weeks to start this business.
How did Mum and Dad feel about
it? You've met my parents.
Seriously, tell me how you square getting a job at Deloitte, quitting after 6 weeks to go into something that doesn't exist yet. How do you square that with Mum and Dad? I'm talking on behalf of all the young people out there.
Sure. I started creating the idea before I started Deloitte. I launched it 2 weeks in. I think the fact that my ugly mug was in 4 or 5 national newspapers and I was invited to speak on 3 or 4 radio stations, I think that gave my parents confidence that I may be onto something. I also told them Deloitte kept my job open for a year so I could go back. So
was that true?
What's true?
That Deloitte kept your job open?
Absolutely, they kept my job and said, Luke, you can come back. We like this kind of personality. We want to encourage more of it in the professional services firm. So I think with all that information, they were quite cool about it. They were quite excited, but very nervous. But I was living at home. It was quite a low risk situation for me. If I was doing it, maybe at Benji's stage when he started Pickfair, that's a much bigger commitment. I wasn't sacrificing a salary. I didn't have a mortgage. I didn't have a wife or kids. It's a very different stage of life. Doing it now, at the age of 30, 35, 40, you know, I guess similar to what you're doing, Mark. It's a risk, and I've got so much respect for people doing it where there's much more on the line. I took a risk, but the risk was much lower at that point.
Benji, what about you?
Whilst I do totally agree that you kind of need to just have that thing in you, and it's the same thing that makes you a pain in the ass to manage, is the thing that means you should probably, you know, ask my old editor at The Guardian, he'll say, yeah, Benji always should have run his own thing. You'll be told no so many times. You'll you know, especially pitching investors, you know, for every one yes, there's 5 no's. And things will go wrong and staff will let you down or they'll leave without, you know, all these things will happen. And if that's enough to floor you, then yeah, you won't make it through. I think one of the the major, major differentiators as well is a level of humility. The founders that I've seen that really struggle are founders who are unable to say, I don't know the answer to this question. They will they'll bullshit. They'll basically try and like fumble their way through all these decisions, not having a clue what they're doing. Whereas I do think that something I learned very quickly was that I had to know what I didn't know and find someone who did. And there is always somebody out there who's had your challenge before. In fundraising, it meant that I had to go and find people that raised rounds before and say, I don't know what the fuck I'm doing here. What the hell is a preferential share? What the hell is EIS? What the hell is a term sheet? What the hell is liquidation preferences? Yeah. This kind of stuff. Just find people that know the answer rather than pretending you know the answer and bullshitting your way through.
With all that's going on right now, is the UK a barrier to startups and businesses like yours looking to scale? Or is there still a built-in advantage and opportunity to living not just in London, but in the UK?
I think the UK is one of the best places in the world to start a business. And
Still,
even with Brexit, I'm not entirely sure, especially for a technology business, how big an impact Brexit will have. Maybe the influx of European talent is probably going to have the biggest impact. But
a dangerous impact or just...
I don't think the UK government are going to put barriers up to the UK government knows that the UK is the hub, the second best place in the world to start a business.
The UK government is pretty stupid.
It's a completely different podcast.
I'll get Benji back for that one too.
And I'd say one of the key reasons is EMI. And for people who don't know who are listening, EMI is the Enterprise Management Incentive Scheme. It means you can offer stock options to all of your employees at the most incredible, most incredible tax benefits. Better, and it's been studied by researchers across the world. It is by far the best system, and so a way to share the success of your startup, encourage people to join a startup, especially to attract talent from the big banks and large industry. It's an incredible tool we have in our arsenal, and I'd say that alone. Let alone the fact we've got incredible access to talent, be it in Europe, the fact with the English language, etc. I think that is why it's incredible to start a business here.
You got a view, Benj?
I think two things are happening in parallel, one negative and one positive.
Is it worth talking about? That's just a neutral.
Well,
sorry, that's my only physics joke.
Let's start with the negative. There has been a bit of recoiling in the investment community, and the impending. I'm not sure if this has happened already. The European Investment Fund pulling out of a huge amount of VC funds within the UK. So a huge amount of VC funds in the UK are matched or bolstered by the European Investment Fund, which is going to go. So that, you know, that trickles down the investment community and increases what is already a bit of a risk aversion compared to the States, for example. So that's the negative thing, is there is a slightly sort of atmospheric thing going on that I think will impact on various investment stages. Also, the other thing that is simultaneously happening is that the rest of, 5 years ago, the only people that really invested in startups were VCs and like tech angels. These were people who would run their own companies. The landscape, the investment landscape has dramatically broadened just in the last 2-3 years, where everybody is suddenly waking up to investing in startups as a kind of, investment asset class in itself. And this is whilst the traditional investment assets like, stocks and shares, property, have all been, flattering to deceive. Suddenly this high risk, high return option is making its way to the city. So, partners at law firms, partners at hedge funds, individuals, corporates, as Anthony was talking about, companies like BMW, they weren't investing in startups 10 years ago. So suddenly maybe the traditional, VC part of the investment community is recoiling a little bit. Meanwhile, everyone else is just catching up. So I think those things kind of balance themselves out.
Can I say something a little bit controversial here?
Yeah, go on.
Two things that do absolutely no favours to the UK business community, and especially startups, are probably two of the most prominent TV shows. But The Apprentice and Dragon's Den.
Such bullshit.
Absolutely bullshit. Yeah. Firstly, Dragon's Den, as a startup founder, should you be giving up 30, 40, 50% of your company? No, not at that stage. As a founder, you need to have enough skin in the game after 1, 2, 3 funding rounds to make sure you're still, there's enough upside in there for it to be a life-changing business for yourself. Plus, the feedback you get is all bullshit. And The Apprentice, obviously, and look, I get it, they're entertainment shows, but I believe the BBC has a responsibility to actually help advise startup founders, entrepreneurs. This is not how businesses run.
I don't mind the entertainment aspect of it, but the sheen which they still try and place on that show, you know, one of the UK's biggest business minds, and these people are all looking to be serious business. That's absolutely appalling.
And it makes you, I think it also sets the message that to be successful in business, you have to be a bit of a hard ass and a dick about everything. It's like, that's just not true.
Yeah.
Like if anything, the most successful people I've met within, you know, the business community are delightful.
And compassionate and yeah, everything. Hot friend,
I love you so. I know both of you, but you know one another. How did you meet?
Through, if you're familiar with elite sport in London, you'll know the Mill Hill Power League, which is where me and Anthony first locked horns many years ago. We were on the same football list, weren't we? I don't know how or why. Yeah.
Are you both good?
Nah.
Yeah, no. After 5 minutes, just sort of breathing very, very hard.
Yeah,
I actually retired a few years back. I think they did a minute's applause at Mill Hill and Barnet Power Leagues when I announced my the end of my career.
Football's a funny one, especially at the likes of Power League, because when you turn up to a Power League, it looks often to the naked eye or to somebody who's not into football like a bit workmanlike, a bit of a dump. Sorry, Power League. But when you get onto the pitch and you're playing, it turns into Wembley. It becomes everything. And I still have this thing in my head when I play that I'm somehow, like, not quite fulfilled my potential, but there as the greatest footballer that ever walked the earth. Same on a dance floor. I literally, it's like somehow physics is defied and I am the greatest dancer on a dance floor.
I firmly believe that the way you play football says quite a lot about the kind of person that you are.
Yeah.
And so when I played football, I was a bit selfish and incredibly self-punishing. And that's kind of the way I am sometimes. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, if that's the case, I'm proud to say I try things that never come off. Guys, as entrepreneurs and founders, you're familiar with probably a good challenge and a bit of healthy competition. So I'm after the answer to this question. I wonder which of you feels you've had the biggest fail or fuck-up story as a founder. Like, what was the biggest screw-up you ever made?
Back in 2012... my wife had reason to join the company. We were about four people. And we did what you should never do when you're running a tech company and do a big bang release. And that's basically saying, look, we're going to effectively relaunch the entire technology of our website. And what we did was we did it right before a huge game at Wembley Stadium and a huge game at Twickenham the day after. What happened? We had 1,000 cars booked on 10 driveways.
Jesus.
This was, we found out, Friday afternoon. So we had 1,000 people that were going to show up. So 990 cars, angry football and rugby fans. Expecting the same parking space. My wife had just recently joined. She was on customer service. The abuse she got. I remember going home on Friday night, and I go to my parents every Friday night for dinner. The closest I've been to a heart attack.
What happened? How did you deal with this 990 people?
We basically commissioned for a car park close by. We paid for that car park to open itself up. And
was it going to open up anyway?
We basically booked out this entire car park. We took over a couple of, I think, a hotel car park. We just basically did whatever we could. We had to cancel everyone's, was your, many people's bookings.
Was your wife currently your wife at the time?
She ruined recently.
Right.
But I basically went home thinking, I've been working on this project, this business, dedicated my life to it for 6 years. We're dying this weekend. 6 years of hard work is over. And customers were emailing our investors, calling our investors. It was carnage. And people lost their jobs because of it.
Wait, your people lost their jobs?
Well, as in, people moved on afterwards. For me, I had to make a decision, like, what do we do? We've just released this new website. It's not working. And
because that's it was a product mistake.
Right? It was a huge product mistake, but it's, you know, not enough quality assurance, not enough testing, etc. We rushed it out. You can do that when you're a small business, when you've got, you know, 1,000 customers, something like that. We had 150, 200,000 customers at that point. You can't make, we had to mature as a business.
Anthony, when something like that happens, and you've been working at the same product for 6 years, and your story's fairly well documented, right? So you were working, you were almost shunning a social life and other life to get this off the ground. When something like that happens, is it just one isolated incident, or is it, oh shit, this whole thing has just been a fucking idea in my head and it's not working, it's not going to work? Was it this, if this doesn't work, I might have to quit time?
It kind of felt like the decision wasn't my choice anymore. Our customers would decide whether they're going to continue using us. And the fact I felt, because up until that point, the website had been built by me. So I knew all the code, everything else. We'd just launched a new website. I didn't know anything about this new language. So I felt completely powerless to sort out the problem. What I ended up doing was we reverted the website over the course of a week or two. And then the guys who built it moved on shortly after. And I rebuilt, I basically said, look, for me to keep this business running, I need to take the power back. I promoted my sort of number two, my COO, to CEO. And I said, I'm going to rebuild this website over the next 2 or 3 months. Better, bigger, and we'll relaunch it, but I will be in control of it. And basically, I kind of rebooted the entire company at that point because I couldn't...
How many times during the... And this for either of you. How many times over the past number of years, while you've had your now successful businesses still facing their challenges, but have you felt this tension between, I don't want to be a control freak. If this is going to scale, I have to spread the responsibility out, and I know what I want from this, and I know I can deliver it, and I'm not going to be happy. I'm going to have to take this back. Is that a tension for you, Benj?
Every day, like 5 or 6 times a day. And it's something that I'm a solo founder for a reason, that I did, I started this company on my own because I knew that that would ensure that it happened quickly. I like moving at pace. I'm an obsessive. I like getting things done quickly. And like Anthony, I'm also an engineer. I have happily surrendered any control I have over the code base. But every single day there are decisions that you think, I could do this myself. However, I am gradually learning, I'm still not very good at it, to accept that you have to empower your staff. You have to sometimes let decisions be made without you.
In order to get things done even quicker.
Just because you can't do everything yourself. Of course you can't. And even if you accept that, like, right, if I remove myself from this process or this decision, it probably will be 80% as good as if I had done it myself. But that's fine. That's all right. So yeah, I don't know if it's the same with you, Anthony, but it's something that I'm not, I'm trying to get a lot better at, which is extricating myself from every single part of the business.
And what just the same question back to you, when did it get scariest for you? What was the isolated incident you can remember that where you thought, Christ, this might not happen?
We were once 10 days away from running out of money. So
How many of you at the time?
There were 6 of us. Mm. And the frustrating thing was, I don't know if Ant's been in the same situation, but the money was committed. It was just a case of getting an investor over the line and making them wire the goddamn money. And at exactly that time, for 6 days, the investor went AWOL. So I was literally trying to work out, right, has this guy died? Or has something awful happened? Because if I don't get his money within 10 days, I can't pay my staff. But and that will never happen again. That was my mistake. You know, I should never have let it get even close to that.
Anthony, you've got a great take on fundraising. We're going to cover that off in a sec. Benj, one of the resources on the internet that Nicole and I referred to when fundraising to get Rebel Tech off the ground was your Hackanoon blog, The Rookie's Guide to Raising Investment, which we will put a link to on the show notes because it's really worth a read. What inspired you to write that?
Just because I was so clueless when I started out. All the way through, I kept on saying to myself, you've got to write this stuff down, because it was a very steep learning curve. I wasted loads of time. I think it's probably the hardest part of running a business at the early stages. I think once you get, certainly once you're more mature as a business, lots of other problems can start to take over from just fundraising. But certainly in the early stages of a startup, especially a startup like Pickfair, where we've been very clear that we need to obsessively build the non-revenue generating side of our marketplace, the photographers and the images, Before we fully go to market, you know.
So you need capital.
Absolutely right. It is you know, image licensing is a marketplace where the chicken has to come before the egg. So we have been reliant mostly on investor money for the last couple of years, and I've decided not to raise through VCs and do big tickets. I've done lots of smaller tickets, which has meant I've spent most of my time raising. Anyway, and the reason I wrote the blog is hopefully it has helped other people raise money, and also it helps me. I probably get a couple of emails a week of people saying, "Hey, I've got this idea. What do you think I should do?" I was like, "Read this blog."
Yeah.
And if there's anything else, anything that's not in the blog, tell me, and we'll talk.
I mean, at times chasing investment has gone for you from creative to a bit crazy, hasn't it? Tell me about how you first met Alexis from Reddit.
I learned to code through a company called General Assembly. Alexis is an investor in General Assembly. And also, one of my projects, I made this, whilst I was learning to code, I reskinned Reddit using their API. So I made an attractive, beautiful version of Reddit, because Reddit looks like absolute shit. And I tweeted at him, and he was like, "Yeah, this is awesome." And he's clearly a very nice, encouraging, good guy. And when I finished the course and I was building Pickfair, he was touring the States, pimping this book that was called Without Their Permission. And the whole theme of the book and his talks was, what you should do is quit your job, learn how to code, and launch business. And I was like, that's what I've just done. And so I went to General Assembly and I said to General Assembly, right, if Pickfair succeeds, you succeed, because you can put this, you know, you can show off about, hey, this great business came out of one of our coding classes. So I got them to introduce me to Alexis. At one stage, he couldn't do it. So I mocked up this entire Guardian front page with Alexis's face all over it and sent that out to him. He eventually agreed to meet me in a coffee shop in New York. So we met in a coffee shop in New York. Basically, he'd never done an investment outside of the UK before. So he was, and his lawyer was quite reticent about it, and it's just quite complex. So he, at the time, was saying, "Benji, I can't necessarily invest in this." And eventually, he did. The reason I wanted him so bad was so I could, and I said this to him, "I want to put you on my first press release."
But Anthony, you've got a different take on fundraising. You've completed your last two rounds. Congratulations, by the way, December last year, right? You closed another round through crowdfunding. Tell me a bit about that.
We, back in 2015, we were looking to raise money. We got a term sheet from Index Ventures, obviously Europe, one of Europe's largest, most respected VCs. But we only had one term sheet. And a golden rule is, when you're trying to raise money, ideally have more than one offer on the table, try obviously to help your negotiating position. But we only had one.
Nicole, I wish we'd known that before. Have more than one offer on the table. Fuck, that's so good.
It makes life a little bit easier. And the term sheet was good, but it wasn't exactly what we were looking for. And so we thought, okay, we'd heard of crowdfunding, but we thought, rather than getting two VCs to, you know, square up against each other, why not have a VC on one side, which they're going to ask for preference shares and additional rights, etc., and then the crowd, which are ordinary shares, which, you know, have a lot of power in terms of the ambassador base and everything else and the PR you can generate off the back of it. And so we thought, okay, well, let's play those two against each other. In the end, we did a hybrid where we got the VC investment plus we got the crowd on top of it.
But tell me about the power of the crowd, because I think there's probably a couple of extra risks you took. One was you counted on people caring about it, but also you counted on being able to handle the beast that is the crowd.
If anything, that gave us much more opportunity to tap into that emotion. Parking is the end of everyone's journey, but it's also the beginning of the experience you're going on. So you're going to a museum, you're going to a restaurant. And so we've got a lot of power to control how good that experience is going to be based on how easy it is, how stress-free that parking experience is. But we also had a lot of homeowners, business owners who are making a lot of money through Just Park. And so they already felt invested in the business. And they just wanted to sort of, I guess, share that journey, share the experience, and be able to help us and ultimately help themselves as well. And with the crowdfunding, it's not just retail investors you're getting. You're getting people who are directors of large accountancy firms, directors of large property companies, people who can open up their black book of contacts and really help speed up your sales cycle or sit on, you know, become an advisory board. So when you get that list of investors through, you go on LinkedIn, you find out where they work. It's an incredible network of really small angels who you choose when you want to reach out to.
But that's the dream and the thing that happens at the end. That's the benefit. On the way, aren't you held to a different kind of scrutiny than you would be, or a different kind of process than you would be if you're dealing with a VC and a piece of paper and some lawyer? Like, you're dealing with people, and that can be quite hard.
You know, for us, all we need is for someone's grandmother to show up, park in that parking space when someone else is supposed to have that reserved guaranteed space, and that customer experience has been destroyed, and we've got to deal with that. And so we're very used to dealing with the public, dealing with their problems. And, you know, with a crowd, I guess the main challenge is being comfortable opening up your business, telling them everything you're doing, what you're doing, how you're doing it, how well you're performing, how well you're doing as a CEO, and being able to and being open to answer pretty much any question they throw at you.
This whole agility thing that the big corporates are trying to tap into with the startup landscape, it's actually quite difficult, because if you're always innovating and you guys never stop coming up with ideas, how do you know when the new direction or the new revenue stream is the right one?
That's your job as the founder, to give yourself room to fail. We are currently doing a few different experiments in terms of where working out where the most efficient route to revenue is. And I've been pretty clear with my team that we're going to try a number of things here, and a few of them might fail. But that's absolutely what we have to do. And again, it's about taking your investors on the journey with you and being really straight up with them and being able to say, we're going to do a number of things here, whether it's testing out new revenue streams, whether it's testing out different team configurations to make sure that you can ship code better. And I think it's probably the thing that differentiates a startup from a proper company, that there is this continuous appetite for experimentation, and that changes. Like I would imagine with Anthony's business, which is a lot more mature and a lot bigger than Pickfair, that constant experimentation stops because you've done all the experimentation and hopefully learned. He's shaking his head.
not at all. But I guess to add to your point, absolutely, you need to keep experimenting and not being afraid of fail. But what you want to try and do is make sure if you are going to fail, you fail quickly.
Yeah.
You don't want to be investing months and months, if not years, of time, of development time, of product time, on an idea that's going to fail.
I think this is consistent within that kind of comparison between a startup and a business. It's like startup years are like dog years. The things you will do and change within a month are what most big businesses will take 2 years to do. You know, and sometimes that's brutal. Like it's a member of staff that isn't working. You have to move pretty quickly to change that because you just don't have time to carry people. Sometimes it's a particular project that just isn't performing, and you feel as if you've given it as much time as you can. It might not be the amount of time that it needs, but you've given it the amount of time that you can, and you have to cut it off.
There's also a bit of a fatigue around the way we are as startups, that we get looked upon as, you know, these are just children's playhouses. And that, I mean, you've both said fail fast, and actually we hear that 25 times a week. Do you feel a responsibility to also try and be a solid growth investment, a good company, a good employer, as well as just herring around trying to break things and fix them again?
I absolutely believe that there is a backlash against tech coming, and I'm frankly amazed that it hasn't been worse already. Like, you read about, ultimately, a huge amount of the bigger startups will affect a lot of manual jobs, and yet still they haven't really rounded on Silicon Valley. You read about the kind of the gentrified communities of San Francisco, people writing to the local mayor complaining about the homeless folk and asking if they can be tidied away, and still they haven't turned on Silicon Valley.
I was in San Francisco with my wife's cousin for a couple of days on a work trip a couple of years ago, and I remember seeing all these restaurants that nobody was in. And I said to her, how does the economy work here? How's things going? And she pointed to the buses that the huge coaches that Google and all the others send back into town every morning and every night to pick the workers up and drive them out into the hills where they get really, really superbly catered for. So nobody's using these snack bars and sandwich places, and so the economy is just shrinking.
But it's not just a concentration of people. It is a concentration of wealth. Like Silicon Valley, in terms of wealth concentration, is bigger and more concentrated than Wall Street. And I do feel, it does feel as if surely at some stage this is going to, it's going to explode. I often even feel it when you look at things like Elon Musk and Tesla, who are these kind of revered, you know, businessman, and you know, he's a revered businessman, and the innovation is amazing, and it's so exciting. But he's also a multi-billionaire who's sending cars into space whilst people are starving, you know, and this kind of this disparity. It does. I don't know if I'm maybe sort of over-egging this, but it does feel like there was a lot of forces happening simultaneously. You look at the forces that contributed to Trump, to Brexit. A lot of it is anger. And often when you're anger and you're a have-not, you look at the haves. And Silicon Valley is clearly an area where there are a lot of haves. Just to sort of get to some sort of coherent finale, tech has to be very, very important it doesn't disappear up its own arse.
Yeah.
Because that will accelerate this coming backlash. And I think that it does happen a lot.
Hot track, I love you so.
What's the one thing that no one talks about when it comes to being a successful founder? So people always talk about failure and failure fast. What sucks about succeeding?
Mental health.
Really? Okay.
It's, as I was saying earlier, being an entrepreneur is a lifestyle choice. The ups and downs, the roller coaster ride you go on, I've been on over the last 11 years, the decline in your social life initially, the impact it has on relationships, I don't know if there have been any studies actually into the mental health of entrepreneurs and what kind of crazy crackpot idiot you have to be to go on this journey, especially like Benji and myself as sole founders.
It's quite lonely.
Extremely lonely. Like you've got Nicole. Like the advice I've given to so many people who are looking to start their business, get a co-founder. It may, like you want to share the ups and the highs and go out for a drink and have an excuse to go out with someone, but also someone to give you a hug when you lose that deal or you don't get that term sheet. Share that experience.
You think it has an effect on long-term mental health?
Long-term, I don't know. Again, I don't know if there have been studies, but it can't be healthy to burn out 2, 3, 4 times a year as I did at the beginning, to not physically be able to get out of bed or tap on a keyboard, to have a brain drain to pick up the phone and talk to someone. Okay, that's extreme, and I haven't had that experience that for 7, 8 years at least, but so many ups and downs, it can't be healthy.
Those first few years, you were at your youngest, so you had to learn to deal with that yourself.
Absolutely. And, you know, those between the age of, let's say, 24 and 26, my quality of life, the standard of living I had was awful.
Benj?
Anthony's nailed it. That's it. It's your head. It fucks with your head.
Yeah.
And also, the you just described us and me as successful entrepreneurs. I'm not. Absolutely not. And I don't think I've felt that.
When will you be?
I don't know. But that constant feeling that you're not doing good enough. That comes back to the mental health issue. Like it's a double-edged sword, because on the one hand, I think you probably need to feel like that to keep pushing a business forward and actually, or even just making the business successful in the first place. On the other hand, it's quite draining to permanently feel like you're not doing good enough.
Mm.
I was fortunate that about a year and a half into starting my business, I was introduced to a social group called ICE. ICE is a group of tech entrepreneurs in London. We were all in our sort of early to mid-20s, and there's now a group of maybe, I don't know, 200, 300, 400 of us. We go to events, we meet up every now and then, and it's being able to talk to other founders who are going through exactly the same thing as you.
Mm.
What Benji said, being 10 days away from running out of money, if Benji didn't speak to other founders, he'd think that was his problem and his problem alone, because a lot of people don't publicly talk about that kind of stuff. I know 50 companies that have been even 5 days away from running out of money. People have had to lay off half their staff within a week of raising money. Being able to share those problems, share solutions, but just have someone to talk to and share the experience is so important.
Guys, thank you for your honesty. I expected nothing less of you, but actually, profoundly, you've done an amazing job.
Hot track, I love you so.
This is where we pick up the pace for the last minute of the podcast. It's called 60 Second Rebellion. This is a quick fire round. No wussing out. I need answers from both of you. Advice to your 16-year-old self, Benji.
Stop trying to be cool.
Anthony, advice to your 16-year-old self.
Start being cool.
Your 16-year-old self's advice to the grown-up you.
You're working too hard.
Ant?
Lose some weight.
You look brilliant.
Thank you.
What piece of ass, Ant?
The most important single character trait for any founder or entrepreneur?
Humility.
Humility. Amazing.
Perseverance.
You're given the power and money to solve one big global problem and one tiny, annoying, day-to-day, small, first-world problem. What big and small problem do you solve?
Big problem, poverty. Small problem, parking.
Nice.
You cheese bag.
I know. But he did just advertise his own company as solving a small problem. But it is.
For me, Mark, it's about the unfair royalty distribution within image licensing.
Yeah.
Okay, no.
Is that
no.
big or small?
That's actually both, Mark.
Yeah, okay.
No. Big anger. People are getting angrier. Small tangled wires, specifically earphones. Look at this, Exhibit A, right in front of us. Mark is holding up a very tangled set of earphones.
Can I tell you a secret? I can't tie laces. Shoelaces. I can, but I can't tie them in a way in which they stay tied for the whole day. I'm not very good at sustaining. I'm brilliant at doing, but not at sustaining. But my fucking headphones, if they were my shoelaces, my shoes would stay on all day. Guys, thank you so much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure, and this is going to be a brilliant podcast because of you two. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Mark.
Did you know that most people that listen to podcasts don't have time to leave a review? Including my friend Tom Whiteley, who works from home. Go on, be a rebel, tell us what you really think and give us a rating while you're at it. Post-match analysis with Lions. So sorry to James O'Brien. Love that, that rhymes as well.
It was good. As they were talking, I was like, oh, yeah, this is, Mark and I have done this, yeah. Oh, the investment, yeah, we went through that. And everything they were talking about, I was able to go, oh, thank God I had you, Mark.
Yeah, well, it totally made me appreciate hearing them talk about. I mean, they opened themselves up to some. They were more honest than I thought they were going to be. Mm. And they talked about depression. They talked about mental health. They talked about the loneliness. And it totally made me appreciate you all the more. I thought they were really honest about the job behind the job. Like, not everybody is fit or set to be a founder and take that much risk. And we were talking with Benji a little bit about the difference between a startup and a small business, and it's a really, really fair point. I think with a startup mindset, you've got an element of risk, a huge element of speed.
Yeah.
Like, things go really, really quickly. You have to make them work really quickly. There's probably an access or an appreciation or an embracing of technology, and then there's a flexibility and agility and a pivot thing that small businesses potentially, or that probably distinguishes them. But you're yeah. used to this. You know this because your entire clan comes from this world,
they
right?
They do, my entire clan. So my whole family, my mum, my dad, my grandparents, my brother, like then my cousins, have all been self-employed and run their own businesses. So it's all I've ever known. And I remember over the years just watching how they handled the good and the bad and the roller coasters that went behind it. So I think I always knew that was what I wanted to do. I just knew I had to find the right business partner and the right kind of place for me. There you go, I got it. Make you feel better.
I come from a different place and none of my people do. My entire family, my wider family, aunties, uncles, cousins, brothers, sisters, mum and dad, all teachers in education, all brilliant, brilliant teachers. My dad was an entrepreneur. Actually, and mum.
Maybe you mean, I love this story. Yeah.
Well, my dad was an entrepreneur. Yeah. He left. I think he left school at 16. Did some stuff with a family business in insurance, but then opened Lee Mark Electrical. Lee Mark being my brother Leon and myself, and had a really, really good business in Liverpool with my grandfather and others who, you know, we still stay in touch with. And mum was there as well, helping out with all the numbers and the phone calls and. But now they're all in education and I don't come from a place where running your own business is the sensible thing to do.
So you're basically the loose cannon in the family.
Well, I'm loose. That's all for this episode of Rebel Talk. I'm your host, Mark Schwakey. Thanks so much for joining us. My thanks also to our brilliant production team at Hard Six Audio, to Spirit Land in King's Cross for the beautiful studio, and to my Rebel Tech co-host Nicole Lyons and producer Meg Wright. Until next time, up the Rebels.
Rebels, rebel, your face is a mess. Rebels, rebel, how could they know? Hot track, I love you so.
and my colleague Meg can cut out anything we say. So literally, you can say anything here.
Cool.
Everything's...
Fuck the police.
Leave that in. Leave that in.